You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the morning of April 8, 2013, Margaret Thatcher died at the age of 87 after suffering a stroke. Reactions around the world to the news were mixed, ranging from tributes praising her as one of Britain's greatest prime ministers to public celebrations with crowds singing "Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead." In Margaret Thatcher, from Grantham to the Falklands, Charles Moore, the former editor of the Daily Telegraph, chronicles the life and career of this woman who, to her supporters, stood up for hardworking Britons, and to her opponents, crushed them. This is the first in a projected two-volume biography and focuses on Thatcher's early childhood through her first 3 years at 10 Downing Street. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings Charles Moore to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Morning.
Now, you were personally selected by Mrs. Thatcher to write her biography. Did this come as a surprise to you?
It did, a total surprise. Back in 1997, she decided that somebody was obviously going to write her biography and that it was a good idea, therefore, she was advised to ask someone in whom she had some trust to allow them to have full access to her family, her papers. And she very kindly picked on me. So
had you known her personally?
I did, yes. I knew her personally from the mid-80s. Not as an intimate, but I was a journalist all through that, as I still am, all through that period. And why she picked me, I never really knew or asked, but a great honor, of course.
Although the Telegraph is a conservative newspaper, and that might have been a reason. Had she already written her memoirs?
Yes, she wrote her memoirs. They were published in, I think, 93, so that was all out of the way, and then the question of the biography arose.
So how open was she with you? Did she want her story to be told in a certain way?
Well, yes and no. She completely opened the door for me. So no records were held back. It was wonderful in that way. And she gave me lots of interviews. But she's not the sort of person who naturally wants to talk about herself. And so we used to have funny interviews because she in her mind, the interview was always a form of combat. She saw it as political combat. And I was simply trying to ascertain historical fact. But she would sometimes act as if I was on television, and even though she'd asked me to write this book, she'd start sort of hitting back, and she'd say things like, "You only say that because you're a socialist," or something like that, and and I'd have to let the waves crash over me. I'm not a socialist, by the way, and get back to work. So it was a very funny experience, but the fact she had turned the key in the lock was the key.
But you also were in something of a bind, weren't you? Because most people are suspicious of authorized biographies.
Well, Lady Thatcher made a very sensible decision, which I should always be grateful, which she said right away, "This book can't appear in my lifetime and I'm not allowed to read it." And she said that because otherwise people would think she was trying to control it. And that makes such a difference. I thought, by the way, she would try to control it even so, because, you know, she's not a shrinking violet. But she was incredible. She literally never said, "Don't say this, do say that." She didn't want to. She just didn't want to know. I was very unusual there.
And I assume you told people who you talked to that had been arranged, so they were a bit more open with you.
Absolutely.
Knowing that she was going to read what they said about her?
Exactly, because quite a lot of people were frightened of her.
Well, while you were working on this book, she'd already had two strokes, hadn't she, and a couple of strokes, and then she started sinking into dementia.
Yes, it was sad. Luckily, in the 90s, I conducted the interviews in the late 90s with her, and that was not possible to continue with them in the 21st century. So I'm very glad that I was able to do that, because as her mental powers declined, it was unfair to interrogate her. So what I used to do was take her out to lunch and have a bit of a chat, pick up nice little nuggets. But it was only in the early days that I could do that sort of concentrated interview, as you and I are doing now, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. When you were researching this book, did you find inconsistencies between what you were learning and what she had written in her memoirs?
Yes. Obviously, people in their memoirs always defend themselves. Why shouldn't they? And this is not always compatible with the broader historical truth. But the other aspect of it is that she didn't like talking about herself, which is, of course, a problem if you're writing your memoirs. And it was my task to get to the specifics, and particularly in the early life. And I had this great, fascinating discovery because I talked to her sister. She didn't have any brothers. She had one sister, Muriel. And Muriel produced all these letters that Margaret had written to to her from the age of 13 to the age of about 40. And they suddenly open up this whole vista of the life of a bright young girl in the provinces, the grocer's daughter, rising through the world, getting into Oxford, trying to become a parliamentary candidate, and indeed falling in love. Because one of the things that Margaret Thatcher had always said is that she had no boyfriends before Dennis, whom she married. And she's quite a truthful lady, but in this case, it was absolutely not true.
Well, she was protecting her image, especially a conservative image.
Yes, and particularly in those days, a woman didn't want to talk about such things, and why should she? But nevertheless, it wasn't true, and her letters reveal all about this, and it's absolutely fascinating. It brings out the character of the woman rather than the myth.
Well, Britain also has very restrictive laws in regard to release of documents. How did you get past the Official Secrets Act?
Yes, I did, because Lady Thatcher went to the cabinet secretary who's in charge of these matters and said, could Mr. Moore be allowed to look at the government records freely? And that permission was granted me. And so I was able to see all the papers that hadn't been released.
You had been a journalist during her career. Were you surprised by any of the things that you thought you might have known that you hadn't known?
I think the basic theme that surprised me was that, you know, she always loves to say that she was a conviction politician, and she was for sure, but she was also a very cunning politician and a more flexible one, and that's why part of the reason she succeeded. And I found, for example, that, you know, she'd always said she wouldn't ever have any dealings with the IRA terrorists, but actually she did through intermediaries in the hunger strikes. Or she said that she'd would never contemplate any negotiations with Argentina when Argentina invaded the Falklands. But again, she did offer concessions through the United States, hoping, and in fact her hope was justified, that Argentina would be so stupid it wouldn't accept them. But in other words, there's a flexibility in her which she never wished to acknowledge.
Because she loved being called the Iron Lady.
Absolutely. As you know, the Iron Lady was thrown at her as an insult by the Soviets. And of course, as soon as they did it, she grabbed it and put it and crowned herself with that title.
My guest is Charles Moore, who left his job as the editor of the Daily Telegraph to write the official biography of Margaret Thatcher, actually two volumes. The first volume, Margaret Thatcher, the authorized biography, From Grantham to the Falklands. This book is devoted in part to her childhood in the English village of Grantham in Lincolnshire. What was it like there when she was growing up?
Provincial and puritanical. Her father was a man who'd had to leave school at 14, but was a very, very intelligent man and would nowadays have gone to university. He was a Methodist lay preacher, as well as a grocer, and a big figure in the little town. And he taught her to read. She knew the Bible back to front. He taught her to recite poetry, and he taught her about the world, the outside world. And he poured into her all the ambitions that he really had for himself, if you see what I mean.
But it was still a modest childhood, at least
it
initially,
modest,
over
yes.
a small-town grocery.
Yes.
Should we be surprised that a woman who spent part of her childhood in a flat above her father's grocery store is alleged to have said something as snobbish as, a man riding a bus to work at age 26 may count himself a failure?
I'm not familiar with that quotation, but she was not a snobbish person, absolutely not. She was a person who believed in opportunity, and she made no distinction in her mind between where someone came from. The question for her was, you know, what were they actually like? It is a great story of, you know, which Americans, I think, particularly recognize, of coming from those humble beginnings. And in her case, it's a matter of class and a matter of sex, because she had to break into a man's world. And so this trajectory from the grocer's shop, getting into Oxford, becoming prime minister, dying in the Ritz Hotel, and then having her queen standing beside her coffin at the funeral is a great story, I think.
Going from grocer's daughter to baroness.
Indeed.
Although, should I be surprised that somebody who comes from the middle class would have become such a diehard conservative? Was her father a Tory?
Her father wasn't a Tory. He was a liberal with a big L.
That was a third party?
Yes, which was not what is meant by liberal in the United States. It's more free market economics. So there was that link. But the conservatism is very strong in the British middle classes, and she brought to the national stage those sort of small town values, which are very much like those of Ronald Reagan, actually, and reached out to those people who were not tribal conservatives with a big C, but had conservative values, blue-collar workers, who were looking for greater opportunities.
Well, she did have the accent of an upper-class person. Had she worked on developing that?
Yes, but not for that reason. What used to happen in those days was that people had elocution lessons as children, and she did because she used to recite poetry in public competitions, and she also had a slight speech impediment, like Winston Churchill. So she was trained, and in those days you were trained with what would now be considered an upper-class accent, but that was... And later in life, Laurence Olivier, the great actor, helped her deepen her voice when she became Conservative leader because it was considered too squeaky.
In 1943, during World War II, Margaret Roberts began taking classes at Oxford University. Was this typical of the daughter of a grocer going to such a prestigious university?
It was absolutely untypical, and she was the first child of either sex from that family to get into any university, I think. It was also untypical because she studied chemistry, which is, you know, a particularly, on the whole, considered a particularly male subject. And she used sometimes to say, if you said you're the first woman prime minister, she'd say, I'm the first scientist prime minister.
But she also was interested in politics from the start. She was not a liberal with a capital L. In school, she was already a conservative, wasn't she?
Well, certainly at Oxford she was. And she found in the conservatives, in these letters that I mentioned, she's very interested in the conservatives as a sort of social background. She wasn't so interested in the pure issues in those days. It was more the sort of milieu and the people she could meet. And I think she was always very, very ambitious.
So this was a networking thing?
Sort of, but with conviction as well. She very much always hated socialism and also the fear, of course, of Soviet communism, which was rising immediately after 1945.
Well, but British socialists were anti-communists.
Some.
The official party, Labour leaders who became the heads of Britain.
The main leaders were, but there was always a strong pro-Soviet element in the Labour Party, which caused a lot of anxiety. And Mrs. Thatcher was very, very keen to, you know, go flat out against anything which could compromise Western, as she saw it, Western civilization.
Well, what was the problem for her with socialism? Was it just simply because it went against what her father had told her the world should be like?
I think she thought that it crushed the human spirit and it prevented human freedom and opportunity. And, of course, in its purely totalitarian form, she was very strong on the fact that Nazism is what the word Nazism literally means is national socialism. And she saw Nazism and Soviet communism as two peas in the same pod, as essentially the same type of totalitarian concept which must be resisted at all costs.
Well, although I would think most historians would see them as equally terrible, but not politically or economically all that similar, but that's
matter. This was her view, and of course her point was Nazism had been defeated, thank God, so you didn't want the Pyrrhic victory in which Soviet communism would end up winning in the long run.
Now, was she popular at school?
She was more popular at school than at university. Her school friends respected her. She was a serious young woman, but a kind one. She was rather unpopular with her contemporaries at Oxford, who felt that she wasn't a studenty type. You know, she wasn't. She was always, you know, beautifully, neatly dressed and ultra respectable. And students don't like that, do they?
Well, she worked as a research chemist after she graduated, but was her goal ultimately to get into politics?
I think it always was. Yes. And, of course, she knew how difficult this was. But I think you have to see all her actions in that light as a young woman, that she was trying to think of the best way to get into politics.
By studying law.
Yes. She said, at Grantham I learnt the laws of God. At Oxford I learnt the laws of science. And as a lawyer I learnt the laws of man. And she regarded those as the three things that had to prepare her.
My guest is Charles Moore. His authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher, From Grantham to the Falklands, is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Charles Moore, who's written the authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher, called Margaret Thatcher, From Grantham to the Falklands. It is published by Knopf. In 1951, Mrs. Thatcher met her husband, Dennis. What can you tell us about him?
Dennis was 11 years older than she. He had his own firm business, and he had served in the war as an officer. And actually, he'd been married before to another woman called Margaret, so there were two Margaret Thatchers. And she left him in the war in one of those quick wartime romances. And she met him on the night she was selected for the first time as a Tory candidate, and she wrote to her sister and said, "I met a Major Thatcher, age 36, plenty of money, not a frightfully attractive creature." So that didn't sound a very good start, but he drove her back to the station right across London so she could get the early train, and he started to sort of pursue her. She didn't quite realise how serious he was, and she was actually in love with another man, and that,
none of which was in the memoir.
None of which, of course, was mentioned in any way. The other man was twice her age, a distinguished doctor who'd invented the iron lung. And they didn't marry because of the age gap. And in came Dennis with a proposal. And Margaret was completely surprised by this.
Did they have similar political views?
They did. They had a strong similarity in their political views. Dennis probably more right-wing than Margaret.
And how soon were they married after they met?
I think they knew one another for 2 years, and the proposal was just a matter of 2-3 months.
He supported her political ambitions, I imagine.
It's a very fascinating thing because he's a very traditional type of man, and yet he gave himself to this project in the most extraordinary way and sort of took a back seat for her and gave her a great deal of good sense, actually.
And that's rare because in most political couples, both are involved in have political careers.
That's correct. And I think it helped that he was older, because by the time she became leader was almost the same week as he retired. And so at her zenith, he was able to help. And he found that interesting. And he used to complain sometimes that it stopped him going to rugby matches. But he had a lot of good sense, which she needed.
Now, many people would have been discouraged by her early election defeats, 1950, then again 51. She would run against and lose to a Labour candidate named Norman Dodds in the general elections. How did the defeat affect her?
Well, that didn't worry her because she knew she was standing in a hopeless seat. But what was the big problem was that could she get selected as a woman with children? Because they had twins in 1953, and there was a huge prejudice against a woman with children being selected. She tried in 1955 and failed, and she kept on failing. And when she finally got selected in 1958 for Finchley, which was a safe Conservative seat.
She had been moved over there because they saw her as a promising candidate?
Yes, but I've discovered at the very last minute when I handed in the manuscript for this book that she only won the selection because the chairman liked her and he fiddled the vote, because actually the other candidate, the man, got one more vote than she did. And he quote, lost two of those chaps' votes and said that Margaret Thatcher had been selected. So without her knowing, she got in on a fraud.
Now, in England, you could do that. You don't have to live in the district. In this country, she would have been called a carpetbagger.
Yes, it's a different system. Yeah.
So she won, and she ran against her Labour. Well, the major opponent was a Labour Party opponent, because the Liberals have always been the third party and not really all that powerful until fairly recently, in fact. What were her criticisms of her opponent?
Well, it was more the overall policy, and it would be a matter of attacking socialism and particularly trade union power, which was the rising difficult issue for the Labour Party. And this became one of the great themes of her career, was the power of the trade union leaderships to, as she saw it, keep the workers down by over-politicising their work and refusing to respond to economic reality.
And did she run a different kind of campaign than she had previously?
Mrs. Thatcher, though a striking character always, was a conventional politician until the 1970s. So she followed the lead from the party leaders. And I think it was really only in the mid-70s, when everything went wrong economically, that she really broke out of the conventional groove. And she said, "I can't stand the way this country's failing. I can't stand the way my party's failing. I've got to change all this, and I should be the leader."
So she served as a member of parliament from 59 to 70. Did she stand out, or was she just a typical backbencher?
She stood out partly because she was one of the very few women, and also because she's always a very tough and skilled debater.
And she was very pro-Israel.
She was very pro-Israel. She sat, her seat in Finchley is one of the few British seats which has a very big Jewish vote, and that helped her to get to know Israel. And she was also very interested in Jewish social teaching. She liked the chief rabbi very much.
In 1967, she was selected by the U.S. Embassy in London to take part in a leadership exchange program. What was her experience in that that program?
Well, she'd never been to the United States before, and she absolutely loved it. And it was a sort of romance with her. She didn't perhaps know a huge amount about the United States, but she just believed, first of all, in the unity of the English-speaking peoples, as she used, rather like Winston Churchill, to say, but also in the sort of spirit of America about freedom and opportunity and the reward for work. And she just loved, she went all round and she loved it. I mean, she had no complaints.
But she was a mainline Tory, but she did stray at times from party line, and conservative Republicans in this country who admire her so much might be surprised that she supported bills to decriminalize homosexuality and to legalize abortion.
She was very against the state interfering in the private lives of people. She had old-fashioned morality, but she didn't have interfering morality. I think that would be the sort of what she saw as a guiding star in this. So she wouldn't quite fit into those categories that are so important in U.S. politics.
My guest is Charles Moore. His book, Margaret Thatcher, the authorized biography, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And then in 1970, she was appointed Secretary of State of Education and Sciences by Edward Heath. And she immediately caused a stir.
She did, because they wanted an economy drive, and they cut free school milk to children.
And she was called Margaret Thatcher, milk snatcher.
Yes, and this nearly derailed her, because she felt, and this was a very important thing in her life, that she was being singled out for attack because she was a woman. And it's true that the attack was to do with how could a woman take milk from the mouths of children? That was the line. And she was deeply upset about this, and she thought it very unfair. And it nearly broke her spirit, actually, and it toughened her up. And she sort of came out the other side, and she knew that never again could she sort of get too worried by these things. She had to fight through.
What was it, her idea to cut the milk program?
It wasn't her idea, actually, and it was all a slightly bogus argument, because the previous Labour government had cut milk for slightly older children. But it was all whipped up into a big campaign, which she wasn't ready for. And it was a nasty moment for her, but it gave her put some steel in her.
Because 5 years later, she defeats Edward Heath and is elected as the leader of the opposition.
Yes. And the point there is her really coming from the outside there. The whole conservative establishment supported Heath. They thought his sort of moderate policies of making compromises with the trade union leadership was the right way to go. The inflation was very bad. There were terrible strikes. And she came in saying it's all got to be different. And so she was very much the candidate from outside the beltway, as you say, in the United States, and the candidate of change. And
did he feel like she'd stabbed him in the back because he had brought her into his cabinet?
He really thought, I think, that she'd stabbed him in the front, because the other ones didn't dare. And she got the prize of courage, because a lot of people were wanting to get rid of her, but didn't get rid of him, but didn't dare. And she made the challenge.
And the rest of the party, obviously, they chose her.
Well, in those days, it was only the members of parliament that chose. And she went to all the sort of backwoodsmen who were fed up with Ted Heath, and she made an essential appeal. It's really about patriotism. She said it wasn't very specific on policies. It was, you know, our country's falling to bits, and we of all parties should care about that, and we've got to toughen up, we've got to change.
And then she was helped by the fact that the Labour government was going through a rough time. The winter of 78-79 was known in England as the winter of discontent.
Yes, from the great line in Shakespeare. And what happened there was that the Labour unions had strike after strike after strike, and suddenly the claim of the Labour government to be able to control this was broken. And Margaret Thatcher seized this opportunity and won pretty convincingly in May 79.
We have a clip of her speaking to the press after she was appointed Prime Minister.
I know full well the responsibilities that await me as I enter the door of number 10, and I'll strive unceasingly to try to fulfill the trust and confidence that the British people have placed in me and the things in which I believe.
The important words there are the things in which I believe.
Yes, that's right. And in the same speech, she quoted a prayer of St. Francis of Assisi about bringing harmony, which perhaps wasn't wholly what happened. But she was coming in very strongly on these are the convictions that matter, and we've got to stick to them.
And two of the big things that she had to deal with were the IRA insurrection and also then the Falklands War, where you end this. But many people in South Africa celebrated her death because she had been such a strong supporter of the apartheid government.
Yes,
what had
not,
led her to that?
That's not true. And I notice this is going around the internet right now, that people say she said that Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. It's not the case. She did not say that, and she didn't believe it. She condemned some of the actions of the ANC while he was in prison, some of the terrorist actions of the ANC. But her attitude was this. First of all, she was concerned about Soviet power. It was a Cold War issue, partly, and how much that might subvert South Africa. But she also wanted peaceful change. And her idea was that you had to engage with the regime. And by engaging, that you could get some leverage. And it was she, above all of foreign leaders, who told the white South African leadership to release Mandela. And she did a great deal of private pressure on that. And indeed, when Nelson Mandela was finally released from prison, he came to number 10 Downing Street and he thanked her because, you know, she had probably more than any other exterior politician, because she maintained a relationship with the white government, been instrumental in assisting the eventual release.
Unlike Ronald Reagan, who just went along with the apartheid government.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because when she went to see Reagan for the first time as president, he did say some things about South Africa which she thought were wrong because of rather what you're saying. And she left the room, and much as she loved President Reagan, at that point she did say to her foreign secretary, "There's nothing there," she said. She was really a bit embarrassed by the way Reagan had spoken. And on the whole, she didn't believe that. She thought Reagan was a great man and they shared many things. But there was that little moment of shock of, did he really understand these issues?
Do you think she exacerbated the situation in Ireland by taking such a hard line?
I think it was a very difficult situation. The IRA prisoners in the Mays prison had a hunger strike.
And Bobby Sands died.
Bobby Sands died, and then 9 other men died. And she couldn't give in to their demands because that would have been giving in to terrorism.
But she had changed their status. They were no longer considered political prisoners.
That's correct.
And that was an important part of the problem.
That's correct. And her attitude to that was that they had committed normal crimes and they shouldn't have political status. They had committed murders and other attacks. And why should they be given... the fact their motives were political was irrelevant to the nature of the crime. And so she maintained this position. And it must be said that though it was very, very painful, she won, because what the IRA was hoping was that by these people dying, more and more anger would accrue. But in fact, after about the fifth death, the protest died down and it became a more and more gruesome thing. And the IRA never again tried this method because all it meant was that, and Mrs. Thatcher very much admired, in private, she very much admired these young men who died. She said how brave they must have been and how terrible it was that the IRA put them through this.
Although later governments have had to apologize for some British policies in Northern Ireland.
Yes, none. Actually, I don't think the specific actions apologized for were on Mrs. Thatcher's watch. But, you know, clearly this is an absolutely fraught subject where everybody has a grievance on every side.
We have very little time left, but I want to deal with the Falkland Islands, the Falkland War. Britain had given up most of its colonies by this time. Mm. Why did she feel it was important to hold fast for these islands, which really don't have all that much significance, but have great significance for Argentina?
Two reasons. One is that there was an unprovoked attack, an actual military invasion by Argentina. And secondly, because all the Falkland Islanders considered themselves British. So that would have been a most massive humiliation and betrayal. And of course, she would have lost her job if she had not been able to restore the situation.
Instead, in fact, she kind of ensured that she would remain in power for a while longer.
That's correct, because it was such an extraordinary turnaround from this embarrassment, worse than embarrassment, to recapture. Very much assisted by the United States and President Reagan. And suddenly, after her colleagues had been trying to get rid of her, they realized that she was right on top. And this was the what inaugurated her period of dominance, which went on for about 7 more years.
I'm assuming you've completed the second volume.
You're assuming wrong, I'm afraid, Leonard. I'm getting there, but you know the amount of work is just huge. But she was a busy lady, and she was in power for a long time.
And will it cover just the political years, or are you going to do
the
years
after? I will
do the
whole of the rest of her life, so include her retirement, her decline, and her death.
And are you going to be consulting with Meryl Streep as to how?
Well, I would love to talk to her. She acting of Lady Thatcher in old age is really uncannily brilliant, and particularly so as Meryl Streep never saw Margaret Thatcher in that condition, and yet the way she, as it were, imagined it was amazing.
Charles Moore's authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher, From Grantham to the Falklands, published by Knopp. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Len.